Incidents of child abuse in one San Antonio district are decidedly higher than in other parts of the city. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. In fiscal year 2016, 179 children who were victims of abuse in San Antonio's District 5 were removed from their households. That's an increase of 58 cases from the year before. An innovative pilot program aims to reverse that trend by using members of the community to reach out to at-risk families. The Promotoras Child Abuse Prevention Initiative will employ the use of non-professional, trained community members known as promotoras, who provide basic health care education to the community. To talk to me about the initiative is Shirley Gonzalez, City Council Representative for District 5, and Victoria Salas, Project Manager for the project at Family Service Association. So this pilot program is specifically to focus on child abuse prevention. And Councilwoman Gonzalez, something about your district in a specific zip code, which is 78207, there are some very high reports of child abuse in that particular district. Can you tell us why you think that might be?
Well, it's mostly related to poverty in the 07 zip code. But this pilot project came, I wanted to start it because in working with various organizations, including Family Services, it was brought to my attention that over 30% of all child abuse cases in Bexar County are coming out of two zip codes in my district. I just had a baby 2 months ago. I'm the only mother on the council and the only member of the council that has young children. So this was something that I felt we had to tackle. I thought if we could focus just on the 07 zip code, which is the area where I live, we could see a significant decrease in child abuse. So what would it look like if we dedicated funds and resources and effort and energy into addressing child abuse just in the 07 zip code? And so through working with the organizations, they recommended a project like this one. Organizations like Family Services have been working with Promotoras for many, many years. They've often been trained at the WETSI, which is our Westside Educational and Training Center, and they know for it to be successful. The problem is always funding. So we thought with a pilot project, with a very dedicated effort, with a very ambitious group of people that will be working, let's see if we can't see a change in the child abuse numbers coming out of the 07 zip code. UTSA is another partner that will be doing all the data collection to determine whether or not the program is successful. And if it is, then we'll look for other funding sources. They could come from the city, they could come from the county, they could come from private foundations. Perhaps the United Way could help. We're looking for 2 years for this program and hoping that we will show a decline in repeat incidents of child abuse.
And so, Victoria, how do you find the participants for the Promotoras pilot initiative?
The participants were found by other Promotoras. I sent some Promotoras out there to the field. Some of them were recruited through Family Service, some of the parent engagement programs, and word of mouth.
What kind of training are the Promotoras going to be receiving within the program? What specifically is going to be different, perhaps, about this program than if they were to go out and provide information on health education?
They're going to get the parenting nurturing training curriculum. That's going to be their specialty, and they're going to have the community health worker training by WETSI, their Westside Education Training Center.
And once these promotoras receive that training, how are they going to find the right audience with which to share that information?
Family Service are going to hire 4 promotoras, and 2 full-time and 2 part-time. The 2 part-time are going to be placed in an organization in the 78207 Air Corps to give another organization leverage and partnership with us. And with the other promotoras that may not be hired, we're going to give them different resources, because let's say we do hire one promotora for whatever reason, she could no longer continue working. We have a pool to draw from that's already trained in the curriculum.
And so, Councilwoman, the fact that these promotoras are coming from within the community, do you find that they have maybe a greater impact than a social worker that may be coming from a state institution?
Well, The idea is that you have a peer-to-peer network. So anytime you're trying to change a culture, the best way to do that is peer-to-peer. So not in some institution coming in and making demands. The promotoras are working within their own peer network so that they themselves have experienced perhaps domestic violence. They themselves have experienced perhaps many of the same things that they would be working with their peers on. The family that's suffering as a result, there's child abuse, can talk directly to their peer about what they're experiencing. And the promotora, they have all the resources to other agencies, other services that can get them the help that they need. So we know that hearing from your friend or hearing from your comadre, hearing from, your mom is much more impactful than hearing from a professional who you may not have any bond with. So it is, often more difficult to get results because it's not necessarily all data-driven in that regard. So it's hard to quantify a relationship or a friendship.
And so, Victoria, is there any compensation at all for the promotoras who are involved in this program?
For those who complete, there will be a stipend given to the graduates. But they're not getting paid to attend, and we're paying for their classes.
And so what can these promotoras expect once they finish the training program, once they're out in the community, and maybe they want to continue on with their careers? Do they often look for a career maybe within the social services realm within the community?
They could, or they could continue their education. There will be a couple that will continue because they have spoken to me and said, this was an opportunity. I didn't know I could learn this much. Now I'm going to be a better parent with the information I received.
So one of the other issues that we have in the 07 zip code is very high unemployment. And so this would give those women the opportunity to further their education and then hopefully get long-term jobs. So that also then helps to stabilize the family.
And I think we also need to mention that it's not just an individual problem, right? Because child abuse does tend to branch off into other problems. So perhaps a victim of child abuse is going to, perhaps find themselves down the road of addiction one day. And I think just by tackling the problem at a certain point, you're already preventing a bunch of other social problems which may arise in the future.
That's right. And of course, child abuse is linked to domestic violence, linked to teen pregnancy, linked to other types of trauma. If we can and hopefully tackle this one part, it connects people to other services as well so that they learn that there's another way. And so the women who are this first cohort of promotoras really are like changing the trajectory of an entire community. Perhaps they're thinking about only themselves or only the few people that they would help. It actually is a citywide issue and could change the face of our city forever.
That was San Antonio City Councilwoman Shirley Gonzalez and Family Service Association Project Manager Victoria Salas talking to me about the Promotoras Child Abuse Prevention Initiative. Nearly 1 in 10 Americans works in the healthcare industry. It's the same for New Mexico, but there's still a shortage of nurses there. KUNM's Sarah Trujillo reports on how some schools are making efforts to get more nurses into the field, especially nurses of color.
Lisa Kennedy-Huntsman showed me around the Pima Medical Institute in Albuquerque earlier this year. I got to meet one of their simulation dummies. It was sitting upright in a hospital bed, arms outstretched and staring right at me.
He's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Cool. Kanigi Huntsman says students come for their accelerated program and the hands-on experience.
Yeah, so he can do everything. They can learn so much because they can kill him, and then they can redo it again. So
applicants must pass an entrance exam and nail an interview to get a spot in Pima's program, and the school will help students who still need to earn their high school diploma. A Pima nursing degree takes just over a year and a half and costs about $45,000, which is worth it to some folks who don't want to wait for a spot in a public nursing program. Two-year nursing degrees at community colleges here cost a fraction of that, but applicants in places like Santa Fe and Albuquerque were often stuck on wait lists, and sometimes for years.
kids. And then they were justifiably angry.
That's Diane Evans Pryor with the nursing program at CNM. She says she really felt for students. They were racking up useless credits that wouldn't even count towards their nursing degree while they were waiting to get into the program.
One woman came to my office and she said, you know, before I tried to get into your nursing program, I was a nice person and I'm not anymore.
Evans Pryor says they recruited more faculty and clinical sites and worked with education officials to adopt a statewide nursing curriculum to allow more transfers between colleges.
We've really pulled out so many of those confounding factors and made it so that this is reasonable again.
CNM also opened the door to lottery scholarship recipients, and Evans Pryor says the number of students moving through the program almost doubled. More and more students are staying to finish their degrees at CNM, according to CNM's annual reports, and the number of students dropping out of the program has plunged. The number of nursing students of color has been steadily increasing, too.
We've got what we need to do the job that we need, and we're rewarded with an amazing student population.
What really pulled me into the, you know, nursing was took an anatomy class and learned more about the human body, and that was just amazing. Got to dissect a cow's heart.
Johnny Bowles says he knew immediately that nursing was his calling. But after finishing up all his prerequisites at New Mexico State, his grades weren't high enough to earn him a spot in the nursing program there. So he took a job in his hometown of Santa Fe, and a couple years later, he tried again.
Finally, I said, hey, you know, let's just go for it.
Bowles got into the program at the Santa Fe Community College. He says getting that letter was one of the happiest days of his life, and he got to start right away.
Hopefully, I would have kept trying, but, you know, I am glad that I didn't have to get on that wait list.
Now he can complete his degree close to home and his family. I'm Sarah Trujillo.
Coming up next on Fronteras, how a Dallas artist is taking a whack at gentrification with a Latin party favor.
What I like about the piñata is that there's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We'll explore that story and meet a border vigilante when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Some of the people whose lives revolve around existing barriers along the U.S.-Mexico border include those who consider themselves vigilantes and actively look for trespassers. KPBS Fronteras reporter Jean Guerrero takes us to Boulevard in East San Diego County, where a retired mechanic stands guard at the border along his property.
Looking good.
Bob Muppin is looking for footprints and other signs of trespassers. He's 78, with blue eyes and silver hair. He's not as strong as he used to be, but he won't let that stop him.
It is my duty to protect my country from people invading it. Without borders, you're no longer a country.
Maupin lives right next to the U.S.-Mexico border fence in East San Diego County. He's carrying a rifle and wears a bulletproof vest as he walks along the corrugated steel that lines his property.
Hell yeah, I'm a vigilante, if you use the word before Hollywood got a hold of it. Because originally, a vigilante, or vigilantes, were people that were enforcing the law because of the lack of law enforcement.
Maupin is trailed by his black lab mixes, Shadow and Inky.
Come on, boys.
It's about 100 degrees out. This is the area where Maupin says he was nearly killed when he was shot at by a smuggler.
He missed me by 4 feet, so I shot the water ball out of the guy's hand and exploded. And I haven't been shot at from down there since then.
He inspects a chain-link fence in front of the original border fence.
And there's a patch where they cut a hole.
He built it for extra security because the government fence is so easy to climb. His fence is taller and crowned with barbed wire, but it often gets cut by smugglers anyway. He's patched it with bundles of chain-link and metal slabs.
Over the years, my wife and I have spent probably $20,000 in fence repair and property repair because of these people.
As a boy, Maupin dreamt of being a Marine. But then a pretty brunette named Jeanette stole his heart. Back in the house, Maupin shows me a picture of her.
She would have had a nervous breakdown every time I've been deployed.
So Maupin stayed in town and started an auto parts business. Jeanette died last year at the age of 76.
The day she died, she told me to get on with my life, and not waste my time feeling sorry for myself. But she was my life.
For the most part, it's quiet out here now. Illegal immigration has slowed this decade, and it's been years since Maupin's caught large groups of people crossing the border. The heavy flow of migration through Maupin's property started around the turn of the millennium with Operation Gatekeeper. That's when the U.S. began its first major border fence project with a focus on securing urban areas. Illegal immigration was rerouted into Maupin's backyard, where it's rural and remote, and crossers seek help from cartels.
Before Operation Gatekeeper, it was wonderful. I mean, we had a good rapport with the people down south. They didn't speak Spanish, or they didn't speak English, they don't speak Spanish, but it was always hi, you know, and whatnot. But then after Operation Gatekeeper, that's when the cartels got involved and were bringing people out from Tijuana, Tecate, out here, and bringing them north.
Maupin says that if the U.S. had built a strong 2,000-mile wall in the first place, none of this would have happened.
If we get a wall like they built in Israel, I probably will not have to wear a bulletproof vest along the border anymore.
He's rooting for Trump's big impenetrable wall, but it looks unlikely. Trump has shifted the focus away from building a longer wall toward remodeling the barriers that already exist. So for now, Maupin will continue to stand guard at the border.
I'm going to die, and I don't care how, except I'm not going to die a slobbering old man in a rest home pushing a walker. I'm going out in a firefight.
For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
In Dallas, an artist is using his work to take a stand for affordable housing. For the past few weeks, tiny house piñatas have been popping up all over the Oak Cliff neighborhood there. It's in response to the numerous luxury apartment complexes invading the area of old, smaller homes. KERA's Hadi Mawagdi takes us on the protest path of an artist, Giovanni Valderas, as he responds to gentrification.
It's a cold morning in Dallas, and it's a holiday. But artist Giovanni Valderas is hard at work.
So when I start these, I try to have my tissue paper cut in advance. And I like to start at the feet, the patas, as my mom would say.
It's early, and Valderas, who's a gallerist and an adjunct professor at Mountain View College, still has sleep in his eyes as he rummages through neon-colored tissue paper.
I try to use colors that are associated with the neighborhood I live in and I've grown up in. So these bright oranges and bright greens, I think, symbolize my community, but also symbolizes hope.
Valderas is creating a sculpture of sorts. It's a piñata, and the piñata looks like a little house with a sad face, kind of like an unhappy Thomas the Tank Engine.
What I like about the piñata is that there's this kind of subversiveness to it, right? In the beginning, it's really fun and festive, and you look at it, and then you start to get it.
He calls these pieces casita tristes. That is, little sad houses.
I'd love to put one here, but it'd probably disappear really quickly.
They're his response to the wildfire gentrification of Oak Cliff. Big new housing developments go up, and Valderas places his sad little paper houses right in front of them. Right. Valderas is part Guatemalan, part Mexican-American. He lives in an area of Oak Cliff that's mostly Latino. And many of his neighbors are in danger of being priced out of the area, and they feel overlooked.
I think one of the most valuable things about Giovanni's work is he is creating a public voice for a larger community.
That's Janiel Engelstad. She runs an organization called Make Art with Purpose. They use art to advance social causes, and she thinks Valderas' little houses could have a big impact.
There is great potential and value for Giovanni's project to grow out of Oak Cliff, because this is not a small neighborhood problem. This is a national problem.
Sandy Rollins, the executive director of the Texas Tenants Union, agrees. Rollins works to help low-income people find better living conditions and to stay in their homes. And she says more people are finding that harder and harder to do.
We've worked with a lot of people who have been displaced. We've seen it happen in Oak Lawn. We've seen it happen in Northeast Dallas. It's happening right now in Vickery Meadow.
Rollins says new construction is one reason land values and rents are going up, and that makes it harder to stay in the neighborhood. The Economic Policy Institute estimates if you make minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, your entire paycheck would barely cover a year's rent at an average Dallas apartment. You'd have nothing for utilities, food, transportation, or even clothing.
There is not enough affordable housing in this city, and I think people are angry at the city's role in facilitating the displacement of longtime residents.
Again, here's Giovanni Valderas.
For me, it's scary that there is this kind of cultural and community erasure that's happening. You know, like, we want to capitalize off your culture, but you can't be here at the same time.
Valderas hopes the Casita Tristes spark conversation about affordable housing and the gentrification of communities, specifically in Oak Cliff. He wants people to reach out to the Dallas City Council and to demand more funding go towards helping low-income individuals. Valderas says he doesn't want growth to stall in his community. He just wants it to be organic. He says Latinos invested in Oak Cliff by opening paleterias, bakeries, and mechanic shops. Those businesses made the area attractive, and he doesn't want them to go away.
I think this is a really important moment that we're in because I think a lot of individuals have taken notice. And I think with these casita tristes, these sad little houses, it can spark that conversation.
Judging from social media, the conversation has started. People are posting photos and sharing the message. Some have even taken the sad little houses and placed them on their porch as a sign of solidarity.
Lost a leg.
Valderas says his casitas are moving faster than he can put them out. For Fronteras, I'm Hadi Mawagdi.
That's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.